Primary, taking the people of the past at their word. I'm Aaron Rock.
I'm Vinny Scutiera.
We are actually recording this on a pretty fortuitous day. I don't know if you know that, Vinny, regarding the subject that we're talking about.
I don't even know what day it is today.
Well, it's Thursday. Do you know that part? Or
yeah, I knew it was Thursday.
Okay. It happens to be August 16th. I don't know if that's... It's probably... Depending on when we actually release this, people might be, thrown for a loop that I'm actually mentioning the day that we're recording this. But given the topic...
August 16th, 2005.
But given the topic that we're actually going to be talking about, something significant actually happened regarding one of the people that this concerns. Well, significant is maybe putting it mildly.
give me a hint at which one of the people.
Okay. It's the one that's more often that could be known by a single name.
Ah, okay. Preceded by the?
Yes, sure.
Okay. is it Elvis's birthday?
No, it's actually the day that Elvis died. Yeah, 41 years ago on the day that we're recording this is the day that Elvis died. And unfortunately, I'm sorry to say that today is also the day that Aretha Franklin died. So we had the King and the Queen of Soul. And actually, this is also the anniversary of the day that Babe Ruth died. So the Sultan. So it's a bad day to be an unofficial leader. To be someone in charge of, or someone given some kind of royal related power over their domain. So
I never heard of Babe Ruth referred to as the Sultan.
Oh, he was the Sultan of SWAT. I guess we'll have
Sultan
to
cut of SWAT.
Yeah, he had a lot of nicknames. But yeah, he was. Did you ever see the Sandlot?
I thought his name was the Bambino, right?
Yeah, well, he was also the Bambino, but he was he had a lot of nicknames. But yeah, this is a totally different topic. But yeah, he was the Sultan of SWAT. Did you ever see the Sandlot?
I saw the Sandlot 30 years ago or something.
when I was
a child, I guess.
We'll make it a point to talk about Babe Ruth some other time, because we'll get back to other royalty. Specifically today, we're going to be talking about the King. We're going to be talking about Elvis Presley.
Now, when I read... So we're talking about a letter that he wrote to Richard Nixon. And I am reading this letter, and he does not speak with the gravitas of a king. We talked a lot about gravitas during Pliny, and yes. I'm not getting that from Elvis here.
I think that's fair. I think you're reading that correctly. No, there's not really a lot of royalty in this letter. it's quite unusual and relatively short too. So good news for those who enjoy listening to these in their entirety. This is something, I guess, kind of uniquely strange in American history, because you have these two known figures. You have Elvis Presley and you have President Richard Nixon. And sure, it's easy to kind of understand that they existed at the same time, but to imagine the two of them interacting, I think is just unusual. it is to me.
So I didn't know that they necessarily existed at the same time, and I didn't know that they didn't, but I I have no idea where this falls in either of their timelines.
Okay. I think that's probably fair. So this letter was written by Elvis in 1970. Specifically it was given to the president in December of 1970. And
that gives me no new information.
Okay, well, I will tell you, I mean, I'll get into a little bit of Elvis's probably biography as we go through this. But Elvis really gained his kind of international fame in 1958.
Okay, so he was already like the king of rock and roll at this point?
Absolutely. In fact, he was maybe coming out of a downswing and coming into what later would basically be called his comeback. He died in 1977, and so this is towards the end of his life for sure. I mean, 7 years later, that's a
really
fair amount of time. But
this letter seems so childish.
Yeah, he was he was in his 30s at this point. But we'll get into a little bit. We'll get into a little bit of why his letter sounds childish, because I think there are some fairly understandable reasons for that. So,
okay.
Once we get into a little bit of what the kind of motivations were for this, and Nixon, just to put it in kind of Nixon's timeline. Nixon took was inaugurated as president in 1969 and was president until 1974. So
early on in his presidency, probably before all of the scandal stuff, the Watergate stuff.
Yeah, that little thing. Now he certainly had plenty of scandals before that, but the main kind of known scandal for Watergate doesn't really happen until, it doesn't really begin until 1972. So a couple years later.
So what was the public opinion of him at this time?
Well, he was relatively new president. I mean, he'd been in the presidency for, almost 2 years. Still pretty, pretty new in terms of governance. So
did he win by a landslide or was it close?
His election was, he'd run for president a few times. His election in 1969.
So they were like, just give it to him.
Yeah, he's tried so hard. Come on, just let the man.
He clearly wants it.
What's
the worst that could happen?
Oh my God, I wish. I wish that's the way it kind of had gone. No, but he did win by a fair amount. I mean, there was no doubt that that he had won that election.
Who was he running against?
Now you're just are you just trying to trip me up now, Vinny, right?
wait. There's no doubt in my mind that you know who he was running against, right?
I mean,
I figured you could go back to the beginning of the United States and name
and
every single election,
every
who
candidate
won, like who was their vice president, who lost, what like the margins were.
You give me way too much credit. But also, you should be proud of me because I could have just made up a name and you would have believed me too.
I would have been fine with that.
Yeah. No. So Richard Nixon ran against Hubert Humphrey. So Richard Nixon was the Republican candidate.
Wait, now I don't trust you.
Well, I was dawdling for so long so I could actually look the information up. So, So Hubert Humphrey was the Democratic candidate, but George Wallace also ran as an independent and was a significant enough factor in the election. But
so
Nixon won with over 300 electoral votes, so a pretty sizable margin. Compared to
so at this time, because I'm going back and I'm thinking of Elvis meaning Nixon, and I'm kind of seeing. I mean, to be honest, I'm thinking of Elvis as the good guy and Nixon as the bad guy, and Nixon's like got his web set up, and he's capturing Elvis in his web. I think mostly I think that because of Futurama, to be honest.
Probably they do a very good caricature of Nixon. They capture his character pretty well. But in this one, Nixon's almost kind of the innocent party here in this story.
After reading the letter, it doesn't come off like that at all. I mean, it totally seems like Nixon is minding his own business, and Elvis is just like really, really pushing himself. I don't even really know for what he wants to help Nixon with these. Problems that Elvis is kind of vaguely referring to, and he's just basically begging to be a federal agent with no real clear indication for what that would mean, at least to me. I don't know.
Yeah. So let's get into a little bit of just to get us to the point of this letter and to understand a little bit more, let's get into Elvis's background a little bit. We'll talk about Nixon, you know, here and there where it applies, but more important in this is kind of Elvis's motivation. And he, like I said, he became kind of internationally and nationally certainly famous in 1958. He was this kind of breakthrough, you know, unique artist and singer, and certainly had this phenomenal voice and stage presence. But he was also initially seen as this it's the 1950s, so very American standard male. I mean, he was at the start of his popularity. Elvis was actually even drafted into the army, and because of his fame and popularity, he had the opportunity to get special treatment, either to be reassigned to be at home, you know, at the home front instead of being sent off anywhere internationally. But he chose to deny some of those special privileges. So he just straight up was drafted into the army as Elvis Presley. And
where did he get sent then?
Elvis was actually sent to, he was stationed in Germany, specifically in West Germany eventually. But this is after the Korean War. So the Korean War, this is after the U.S. involvement in the Korean War, I guess we could say. Because I don't even think we're officially in the after the Korean War time period right now. But he was given the opportunity to have some special treatment, to just do kind of 6 weeks basic training and then sort of be this just figurehead. Just let this guy entertain the troops and everything will be fine. And he had no intention of signing up for any of those, special services positions. He joined the armed forces. Possibly one of the motivations might have been because they would have been having him basically having this internationally known and, you know, world famous artist just perform for free, so there might have been some monetary motivations there too. But also, he really did seem to have a genuine patriotism.
Comes through in the letter.
Oh, I think so. However, it was during his time in the army that reportedly he became addicted to, among other things, barbiturates. So addicted to pain medication and prescription drugs.
Isn't barbiturates the thing that you make asphalt out of from this lake in Judea or something?
No, but you're close, I think. So, well, you probably could with how harsh barbiturates can be. You probably could make some.
So I don't know what barbiturates are.
It's a pretty intense classification of drugs. It depresses the central nervous system. It includes like anticonvulsants and hypnotics.
But is there like a layman's term for this? I've never heard that word, barbiturates.
You've never heard barbiturates before? Okay.
I can't tell if you're teasing me or if you're being serious.
No, I just don't know what else to maybe even call them.
If there's a guy on a street corner and he like, you know, gives me a come hither motion and he pulls open his trench coat, he's going to say like, hey man, you want some barbiturates?
Maybe. Let's see if there. I'm trying to think of some. I'm trying to pull up some specific medications that are in this classification that maybe you would recognize. Phenobarbital. Are you familiar with that at all?
So is this like prescription drugs? I've heard of that.
Yes. These.
Okay. So he's taking like prescription painkillers or something.
Yes. This is a classification of a certain type of prescription drugs. Specifically ones that affect the nervous system most of the time. This is the classification of drugs that are typically used in like euthanasia and anesthesia. Whoa. They're still used to treat epilepsy.
So he'd have access to those because it's a military base or something and they're doing triage, and so they have these really intense painkillers or something.
You know, I don't know if anybody can say for sure when he first, how he first really became exposed to them. But one way or another, he started abusing barbiturates and other and stimulants. So you know that, right? You know that classification of drugs, right?
I know what stimulants are, but I've never heard of someone saying, "Yeah, I have this poor friend and he's addicted to stimulants."
I mean, usually,
like, is it cocaine or something? Isn't that that's like
cocaine
a stimulant?
Is
no,
definitely a stimulant. Yeah, it's a. I mean, you know, stimulants compared to depressants, right? So,
yeah, but I feel like what was he taking? More prescription drugs that were stimulants?
Yes, all sorts of prescription drugs.
But he wasn't taking like cocaine or I don't know.
He very much was not taking cocaine and was not taking, or at least not by any reports. He was not taking illegal drugs. And it's very important to keep in mind, which is not to say he was not taking drugs illegally, but okay. he was not taking illegal medication or illegal drugs. He was
okay,
taking.
That's why it sounds so strange to me.
Yes, he was taking legal medicine. He was largely taking it in an unauthorized, unprescribed way, but.
So we really don't know how he started on this.
There's not really any strong information on it. Some of the best information on his addiction comes from his friends and family and people who were close with him. And I don't think anybody has a report of how he was first exposed to you know this kind of drug use. But obviously this is something that plagued him for a while.
How did the timing of his drug use compared to, you said his career took kind of a dip.
Not exactly sure if it was related at all, but it's certainly based on information, especially from his wife, Priscilla, it certainly continued to amp up. And by the time, by the time he was at the height of his career, he was still very heavily abusing prescription medication. Mm-hmm. He kind of, again, by family and friend reports, didn't really see this as wrong. He was taking legal drugs and therefore did not have a problem, is what, again, what his family, you know, made mention of. So... And it obviously
that
didn't
makes
affect
sense
his...
based on the contents of the letter that we'll talk about that, you know, he wasn't seeing what he was doing as being part of like the so-called drug culture.
Exactly. So, I mean, we could talk about more details of his biography. I mean, he had several movies that were very popular and obviously tons of Grammy nominations and had a very successful career in a lot of different avenues. This did not seem to necessarily impact it at first. And even during his kind of sort of downswing, it also coincided with a lot of just personal family issues, and everything may have, you know, so his daughter, Lisa Marie, was born in 1968. He had started becoming just sort of dissatisfied with his career or the path that it was going, and so that may have all been bound to happen anyway. but certainly I am sure heavy years of drug abuse didn't make that better. It's kind of the thing that we've gotten used to for certainly musicians and popular ones at that, but partly because of, I guess, his influence. Unfortunately, but so, you know, late 1960s, his career kind of wasn't disappearing. He was still, he was still popular. He wasn't really performing. He hadn't performed in a while. But
was he still releasing music?
He was, yeah. But not too many, you know. Not too many of his singles were charting the way they used to. And it, you know, there certainly was a lot of competition in the 60s and a lot of kind of musical change. Mm-hmm. But he, you know, he started this kind of comeback tour, and although I don't think they called it a comeback tour at first, it was eventually basically it became what everybody called his his comeback special was certainly one of the performances. But he, you know, so he was performing all over the place. He was Elvis again. he was selling out crowds and performing not just the hits, but he had some great, you know, great new success. Suspicious Minds.
When you think of an Elvis impersonator, which one matches with this time period?
Okay, so this time period is the sparkly jumpsuit, you know, overly done cape. Yeah, exactly. It's the biggest stereotype Elvis impersonator. This is this time period. So, you know, one of my favorite songs of his, Suspicious Minds, came out in 1969. So this is certainly not, he's not at the bottom at any stretch of the imagination after, you know, at this point. So he's
selling
out. Did
people know that he was addicted? Like, did the public know that he was addicted to those drugs at this point?
Not really. It was not, in fact, even after his death in 77, I found newspaper articles disputing him being involved in any kind of drug abuse at all. So his reported cause of death was related to basically heart failure, and some people came out and said, well, it was related to long-term drug abuse, and others said, no, absolutely not. Of course not. He just liked his fried peanut butter and banana sandwiches, which he also did, but it's become pretty obvious since then that it certainly was related to this kind of long-term drug abuse. He was selling out stadiums. He had these just huge performances. I mean, he was still the king. I don't think there was ever a point where he wasn't the king. he was just typical Elvis, even here.
So that's why the letter seems so strange to me then, knowing that it wasn't like this was right at the beginning of his career when he was first getting started, or like even before he got started, because it comes across as, maybe I'm mistaking his what am I trying to say, like his genuineness for childishness. But so he writes a letter to the president, and it's very much like, wow, you're the president, that's so great, I love the United States, I would do a good job, let me do a good job, I really want to do a good job, thank you for reading my letter.
My name, Elvis Presley, 36 years old.
Yeah.
It is, so the story of this letter getting written, according to his family, including Priscilla, and she talked a lot after his death of kind of his mental state, I think. And she and another family member described this kind of, it's December, it's, you know, December 1970, it's almost Christmas time, and somebody was a little upset with Elvis. Somebody in the family was a little upset with Elvis because he spent so much on these lavish presents for everybody. And he was kind of famous for that too. He famously gave pink Cadillacs to people, kind of just because a fan might get a pink Cadillac from Elvis Presley. But he was, so supposedly he had these expensive gifts, and it kind of led to this sort of family you know, just a little family squabble of, you know, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't have done that much, and you know, the way families might be. Even for,
I think that's kind of mean. You know, he made all this money. If he wants to spend it on gifts of all things, I don't know.
Yeah, I kind of agree.
I would say, come on, Elf. Let him buy people pink Cadillacs.
Yeah, although I think it was probably coming from a good place. That family was trying to look after him and make sure he wasn't. I mean, they probably also saw him in this position because it almost certainly was combined with kind of a period of intense drug use. So the, you know, the story is there's some, you know, some upset, and he gets on a plane and goes to LA for a while and just, you know, just whatever, fine, I'm gonna go do whatever it is that a celebrity in 1970 gets to do, goes to Vegas for a bit of time, probably picking up every prescription bottle he can find. That's my interpretation, not any strong evidence, but then gets focused on this idea that he's had for a long time, which is that he wants to help his country again. He knows that he can. Well, Elvis also famously had this kind of obsession with law enforcement. He really liked badges. He collected badges and law enforcement memorabilia. And, you know, this wouldn't be something that necessarily every member of the public would know, but people who really were big fans of his and people who were close with him would know that he had these kind of collections. He collected all these different enforcement, law enforcement badges.
They do mention that on Gilmore Girls.
So do they?
That was one thing I knew. Yeah.
Ah, very cool.
I had no idea what they were talking about at the time, but.
So, yeah, so he was very, very pro-government law enforcement. And so he, you know, collected weapons and badges and everything else. So he's focused on thinking about this, probably with some stimulants and barbiturates in his system. Mm-hmm. He is now thinking, hey, I know what I can do. I'm gonna do that thing that I've been thinking about for a long time. I want a federal drug enforcement badge. That's what I want. That's what I need. I'm Elvis Presley. I'm gonna go right up to the president and I'm gonna ask for one, and I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna get it. And he was also at some point on a plane with a senator. They were talking about, you know, the problems plaguing this country and all of the, you know, all of the things that were going wrong. I mean, it's the 70s. There's all sorts of civil unrest and people demanding rights and recognition and not wanting to be drafted into the military and, you know, wanting the freedom to do what they want to do. God forbid. And so he gets this idea, and he literally on a plane, because he's writing this on American Airlines stationery, writes this letter to Nixon. He's like, I'm just going to go meet the president. We're just going to go to DC and I'm going to go meet the president and ask if I can have a badge.
So did the president get this letter?
He did. So
would the president get a letter from just anybody, or was it because it was coming from Elvis?
It was probably because it was coming from Elvis, although anybody can send a letter to the president. But at what point it gets to the president is, it probably varies based on content or time, like, or the president.
What if Justin Bieber wrote the letter, or a letter to a president?
It would probably get through. The difference, though, is Elvis personally delivered this one.
What?
So he walks himself up to the White House, meets with a close aide of Nixon, who also happened to be, by the way, a very big Elvis fan. And because, I mean, who wasn't? And he's Elvis Presley. And gives him this letter. With the intent of having it get to
the president. So was this before there were Elvis impersonators? Because that would be my, if I was working White House security out and I saw Elvis walking up, I'd be like, lock the place down.
very few Elvis impersonators would have come with the entourage that that Elvis himself would have come with. And certainly even then, I mean, this is, there would have been enough security that some guy is not just going to be able to walk up. But the first known Elvis impersonator did actually exist in the 1950s. So,
oh, okay.
So yeah, but nobody's going to be swaggering up quite the same way as the king himself. It's, so he gives this letter to one of Nixon's close aides, and it includes his contact information, as you've pointed out. And, you know, he waits for a meeting. And he gets one. So the letter
does. Wow. Oh, so he actually got to meet with Nixon. Did he become a federal agent at large?
Well, let's look at his, let's look at the letter itself. Let's break down a little
sure.
bit more of what he's looking for and what he's hoping to achieve before I tell you whether he gets this badge or not. So, of course, he starts off a letter introducing himself.
As you would.
To do that. Right. Hello, my name is Elvis Presley. You may know me from all of popular entertainment at this point.
Well, he doesn't say that, but he does say that he has great respect for your office, which, I mean, it's not not strange to say, you know, that's a nice thing to say.
That's appropriate to say to the president.
Littered throughout the letter are all these little things that make it seem like he's just, like, all I can think of is that he's like a fanboy. Like, he just loves, I mean, I guess that's what you're saying. He loved the police or what have you. So
yeah, he was just he really
everything about government. He was just like, oh man.
Well, he was a
presidents
very,
are awesome.
He was a very American boy. That is the personality he was given, kind of by popular media, but it was given to him rightly so. I mean, this is a person who could have gotten out of army service, and so many people in 1958 would have loved to get out of army service, and he could have done it like nothing, but instead, you know, decided he really did, and I think it is genuine, wanted to serve his country. I think it is appropriate to say to the president, I have great respect for your office, but I think you're right that he kind of is a you know, law enforcement fanboy. He mentions weeks before that he'd been talking to Vice President Agnew.
Yeah, I want to know how that meeting came about.
Oh my gosh, me too. I mean, Spiro Agnew was not exactly known he wasn't exactly like a schmoozer. So I would like to be, yeah, fly on the wall there. I kind of imagined Elvis just sort of accosting Vice President Agnew.
Right. I mean, based on this letter, it seems like President Agnew is sitting there, and then, like, the tree of a little potted plant, like, raises up, and Elvis is underneath it the whole time, and he's got his, like, autograph book.
Excuse me, can I tell you about how terrible the hippies are for our current, for our country?
Yeah,
right.
Okay, right. So the very next thing, you know, he mentions that he talked to Agnew. The very next thing he says is,
the drug culture, the hippie elements, the SDS, Black Panthers, etc., do not consider me as their enemy, or as they call it, the establishment.
The establishment.
And that's really the only reference he makes to the problems that are going on. And he doesn't even say, hey, they're a problem. He just says them as if it's known, hey, these guys are the enemy. Like, we're all fighting a war. Like,
exactly.
You know we're fighting a war. I don't have to mention it. I'm just telling you, I want to be enlisted in the war. Is this something that everyone was feeling? I mean, I don't even know what the SDS is.
So you've heard of the Black Panthers, though, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the SDS were the Students for a Democratic Society. It was established in the 60s. But really became known for its activism against the Vietnam War specifically. And this was, and really, you know, kind of this sort of American war mentality that was in existence at this time, in any case. So they were, you know, fairly active student organization, but they would have been, you know, by somebody like Richard Nixon or somebody as pro law enforcement as Elvis Presley, you know, kind of would have been seen as being in league with some of these nefarious other groups that are just revolutionaries and trying to bring this country down. And they certainly, you know, there were factions that had less than desirable methods. But
can I ask what just the general opinion of the public at that time would have been of that specific group, the SDS?
Hard to say. Public opinion was very, very, very split at this point. So it's, I mean, because that's part of the thing that led to the activism of the 60s and 70s was just this divisiveness of student activists or versus they were kind of always put towards, all right, you are either for what the government is doing or you're for communism, like that was the line that other people would draw. It's not unlike some of the division that exists today, that if you start expressing doubt in a particular, especially military methodology, you might be seen as being in league with terrorism. It's the same kind of sharp line that that prevents really free free discussion and debate. But to give you an idea, this is jumping backwards in time quite a bit, but during his 1960 presidential election campaign, Richard Nixon gave a speech about communism and what communism means and how terrible it is for free peoples everywhere and the people of the United States specifically. And this was kind of the side that Nixon was on, was just this very, very anti-communist, therefore liberal organizational kind of groupings.
Okay, so then even if the general public, you know, some people maybe supported the groups, a lot of people didn't, Nixon very clearly did see these groups as trouble.
I think that's fair to say. They certainly are, later in his presidential career, they're certainly, you know, maybe not the SDS as much, the Black Panthers and in general hippies are certainly scapegoats that he starts to use for some of the problems that the country is facing. I think the the characterization you mentioned of Futurama, of Nixon on Futurama, gets at that quite a lot too. That it's you know, if anything's wrong, it's all the hippies' fault.
The dirty hippies, yeah,
exactly, yeah. and that's just kind of a very simplistic view of the, you know, nothing is black and white, so to speak, but very simplistic view of the split of the time. And Elvis demonstrates that pretty perfectly here. I mean, the fact that he doesn't add a lot of preamble to say the drug culture, hippie elements, you know, they...
Right. He doesn't have to present a case at all.
No.
He's just saying, hey, we both know these groups are bad news.
Yeah, and I'm not the establishment. They don't see me as the establishment, as they would see the president. So, he doesn't call it the establishment, though. He calls it America.
He calls it America. Yeah,
and he loves it, sir. So he is expressing an interest, you know, genuine or otherwise, to be of service to the country against these less than favorable elements, these socialist, communist students, children, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, the Black Panthers were they're seen still as having been very militant, but they were really very very socially conscious, and some of the militancy hides some of that, but some of the militancy was a genuine self-protection aspect, you know, carrying guns to keep them from being murdered. A side note, the Black Panthers arming themselves caused a Republican governor of the state of California to support gun control legislation. That Republican governor's name you probably also know because his name was Ronald Reagan. So somebody who is still seen as one of the most modern conservative presidents of our time supported gun control in response to the Black Panthers. Again, that's a separate kind of topic, but it just shows you how but it shows you how divisive this kind of time period was, because that wasn't very, you know, that wasn't very far off from this.
So he goes on to say,
"So I wish not to be given a title or an appointed position."
In such a way where it's like, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, "Elvis, take this title and this appointed position." I don't want that.
I don't want that. No, thank you.
Like, it seems very presumptuous. King. Like, right, knowing now that this was in his more popular, or after he became so popular, the presumptuousness makes more sense. But still, it just seems like Elvis is just a little bit skewed with the reality. Like, his thought of how this interaction is going to go is like, the president is sitting there wishing that I would send him a letter that says, make me an agent. This is going to be a dream come true for him. I know the first thing he's going to want to do is appoint me.
I know, maybe he's going to want to make me the head of the FBI or something, but I don't want that. Right. That's too much. I'll be happy enough being a federal agent at large. Thank you for that.
Now, is that a thing, or did he make that up?
I mean, it's a thing. It's a thing.
Okay.
Enough.
So it's not.
It's not totally
fictitious.
It's not
just some delusion. Okay.
No. But he certainly is. He certainly is pushing for it. He's saying like, hey, if I have this. I've already got the support of all these kids or these people of all ages. Listen to me. I'm not part of the establishment, but if I get this badge, then I'm even more ready to go. I don't know if he thinks he's going to be like arresting people at his concerts or
that's what I want to know, because he's saying, okay, I'm an entertainer, and he says he's going to do this his way, which is communication with people of all ages. So why would he need the badge for that at all? Like, why can't, if he really just wants to kind of communicate a message that's, you know, anti-drug culture, anti-hippie, what in the world would a badge do for him?
That's a great question. What do you think it might do for him?
I'm thinking it would be a centerpiece in his collection. Like, what I want to know is, does he believe what he's saying, and he's just kind of like so caught up in his own love of authority that he desperately wants to be a part of it? Or is he just trying to con Nixon into giving him a badge? Like, is this a grift, or is this him being swept up in delusion?
I don't know. I think it's more maybe on the delusional side of things. I think the way I read this letter, knowing his personal history, is he is just high. He's just while he's writing this, and that speaks to some of the childishness that you've mentioned, that it really seems like he is probably just so far gone when he's writing this that I think he does believe all of it, but I'm not sure that he's in a sound enough mind. Let me tell you what Priscilla later said. She theorized that he thinks at this point, as he's writing this letter, that he thought that he would be able to have this badge and travel anywhere he wanted with whatever drugs he wanted, whatever supply.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. That if he had this federal agent badge, federal agent at large, this official government thing, that he would be able to go into different countries or take what he wanted from people or travel, you know, get on and off, you know, planes or go state to state without any problems, because he'd have this federal badge saying, no, it's okay. See, this is work. This isn't.
Well, that makes me think it's more of the, you know, him pulling a con, because that's so the opposite of what he's saying in the letter. You know, in the letter, maybe, he says, I have no other motives than wanting to help the country out.
Yeah, but I'm not sure he's thinking about it that way. I'm not sure he's, so maybe it's just somewhere in between, but I don't think his brain was functioning properly, as this was happening, which is unfortunate and sad, but certainly that's one of the things that drug abuse can do to someone is cause you to lose sense of reality. And one of the things that he doesn't specify in this letter, but he talked about based on the notes that were taken during his meeting with Nixon, is he talked about the Beatles quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about...
In what context?
Oh, in quite an interesting one, actually. He said, he indicated that he thought the Beatles had been a real force for anti-American spirit, and he basically resented them coming to this country, making their money, and then leaving and going to England, promoting this anti-Americanism, because they certainly were part of this hippie culture, especially right at this point.
Is he at all jealous?
I don't know. I mean, there is this sort of rivalry that existed between Elvis and the Beatles. They kind of trade popularity back and forth, but it's a dividing line. But what's interesting, so I'm going to read a bit of this memo. So here's the memo for the president's files written about this meeting, and I didn't have you read this, but maybe we'll make sure to share a link to it from the website. That is written by a person who was present, Bud Krogh. And one of the things that he describes is, after Elvis kind of goes on about the Beatles and their anti-Americanism, and the president then indicated that those who use drugs are also in the vanguard of anti-American protest. Violence, drug usage, dissent, protest, all seem to merge in generally the same group of young people. And Elvis Presley keeps saying...
And Elvis was like, but you mean illegal drugs, right?
Yeah, pretty much. He says that he tearfully and emotionally says that he's on the president's side, and that he knows that they, you know, that he could be of help, and that he's just... You know, he was just a poor boy from Tennessee, and he just wants to do something for this country that's been so good to him. And he also talked about how he'd been studying communist brainwashing and
so
drug
he mentioned
culture.
That in the letter too.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, isn't it?
Do we know if that is real?
I don't know if
him studying communist brainwashings.
I haven't found any of the details of that, because I think that would make a fantastic movie. Elvis Presley studying communist brainwashing techniques. Just that alone, I would watch for hours. But I have no information about that. I couldn't find any records of beyond basically this letter and his assertion of that. So, but I do believe he's done an in-depth study of drug abuse. which he also claims here. But what's also very concerning, and I think I mentioned earlier that Nixon kind of seems like he's the, you know, the victim in this. He's just Elvis just shows up. He's like, hey, Mr. President,
yeah, right.
I've got Nixon said numerous times during this meeting that he didn't want Elvis to lose his credibility. He said, okay, this sounds, you know, I can hear what you're saying. Sounds very interesting. I just want to make sure that you retain your credibility. And it's listed a few times in this memo.
Meaning, is he talking of the point that Elvis mentioned where, hey, they don't see me as the establishment?
I'm not sure.
Or is he saying, hey, if we look too deeply into drug abuse, it's going to be pretty clear that you're, like, one of the top offenders here.
I think that might be it. I think this might be Nixon tactfully saying, okay, except you need to calm down a little bit, man. I think it would have been fairly clear that he was, I mean, just the description of how affectionate Elvis was being during this meeting. I mean, he's tearful and emotional, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it seems out of sorts for his.
Yeah. When you mentioned that, and I, after reading this letter, the picture in my mind is just a very unbalanced person kind of throwing himself at right. you. And that makes me right. think that's actually kind of sweet that Nixon just turned, like, knew what was going on and kind of turned him away. I'm not endorsing drug use or anything, but it seems weird that Nixon wasn't just like, security.
Yeah, get him out of here.
This guy is clearly not.
It actually seems like one of Nixon's kinder moments, honestly. So that being said, Elvis is specifically asking for one thing in this.
Wait, and when he asks it, I love how he says, I think on the third page, he says something like,
I will be here for as long as it takes to get the credentials of a federal agent.
And on the fourth page, he says,
you can have your staff or whomever call me anytime, today, tonight, or tomorrow.
So it's like, tomorrow will be the longest it could possibly take. Exactly. To become a federal agent. I mean, I know that you're going to want to jump on this.
I know it's an offer you won't be able to turn down. Let me tell you. Towards the end of their meeting, Nixon does give him a badge.
What? Like, he literally makes him a federal agent at large, or just like he opens a drawer and gives him like I visited the White House badge. Here you go.
Oh, man, that would be so hysterical. So Elvis receives a badge from the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. Like an actual, real badge. I'm not sure what power came behind it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Did he use it? I mean,
it certainly would have been.
What were the repercussions of this?
Nothing significant as far as I can tell. It certainly would have been the prize of his collection. He also, I think this is so very like celebrity of him to Elvis came with two supporters, two of his associates, and so at the end Elvis is asking Nixon, he's like, would you meet with these guys too? They came with me all this way. and Nixon obliged and shook their hands and even gave them, a gift from the White House, basically. They have all sorts of things like this on hand.
Okay, I thought you were going to say that he just gave them badges too.
It's
just like, no. You know, and this guy sat behind me on the plane. He was really nice. Okay, he's a federal agent too.
No, but he gives these guys these just little, they're tie pins or something, watch clasps or something like that, just some little White House trinket. And Elvis has the nerve.
Well, I didn't get a little tie clip.
No, but what he says is, well, Mr. President, they have wives also, and so they got brooches for their wives. Which is just, again, so he's, it's Elvis Presley just in the Oval Office. He probably could have picked up furniture and walked out the door. Right. And somebody would
I mean,
have
to be fair, Elvis didn't come empty handed. Sent a short autobiography of himself and then also had a personal gift.
Yes, he did. And can you guess what that personal gift was?
So my guess would be like a pick or something, like a guitar pick or, I don't know, sunglasses.
Sunglasses, one of those sequin jumpsuits, I think.
That's right.
Like the eagle on the back.
Custom made for Nixon, yeah.
A pink Cadillac. No, it was... So I mentioned he collected all sorts of law enforcement paraphernalia and military things and things. So the report was that it was a set of World War I pistols mounted very nicely on a lovely board. And I'm not going to say, though, that he... These weren't necessarily specially purchased or mounted or anything for the president himself. He basically took it off his wall. Elvis was like, oh, I'm going to give this to the president. Here we go. I've got this nice collection.
Well, now I'm thinking the security officer was even more lax when this guy comes up. He's got these pistols. He looks like Elvis.
Just looks like it. Oh, I'm sorry. I said World War I. They were actually World War II. It was actually a World War II pistol. Because Nixon, of course, later, wrote his thank you letter. Thank you for meeting with me. And I appreciate your thoughtfulness in giving me the commemorative World War II Colt 45 pistol encased in the handsome wooden chest. Just another strange note. Here's a note from Richard Nixon. Dear Mr. Presley, signed Richard Nixon.
That's so strange. Why do we have copies of these letters?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. Because they went to the president. Just about everything that goes to the president belongs as much to you and I as it does to the president himself. These things become part of the presidential collection. Unless it is specifically classified information, these things are well documented, well preserved. Gifts given to or from the White House are not, they can't be sold, really. If a president took, if he'd taken these World War II Colt 45 or this World War II Colt 45 pistol and tried to then just like sell it to somebody, that would have been a big absolute no-no.
Oh, really?
Because these things really are given to the president, but it's given to the people on behalf, the president accepts things for the United States. Now that's more in line when it's diplomatic gifts and things, which it's just not like the president can't accept personal gifts, but in order to keep everything above board and make sure nobody is violating the emoluments clause of the U.S. Constitution, then all of these things are very, very well documented. Meetings with members of the public, meetings with celebrities or diplomats or other heads of state, gifts that are exchanged in all directions to make sure that everything is happening. Everything is kind of kosher. So, and then these things get archived. So Elvis's letter to the president, Nixon's letter back. There's even actually a nice picture of the Colt pistol, and it's lovely, lovely wooden box, and I'm sure it's still secured somewhere, whether it's in a National Archive or in the Nixon Library or something.
The attic,
stored in the White House attic.
So in a couple of years, we could just send transcripts of all of our episodes, and then they'll be saved forever.
Pretty much. The Library of Congress may actually be doing some of that stuff right now. We don't even have to go through the president. There is a huge, huge effort to archive as much American information as possible. In fact, up until this year, the Library of Congress was archiving every single tweet.
Whoa.
They realized very quickly they did not have the resources to do that, so they've prioritized a little bit.
I don't see lack of resources is the problem there, but I guess this is a whole other discussion.
Definitely. So, but yes, it is very strange the way he mentions, I've got a personal gift for you, Mr. President.
And I'd like to present it to you, and you can accept it, or I'll keep it for you until you can take it.
Exactly. I'm not sure.
However long that takes, either today or tomorrow at the latest.
Really not sure what he meant by that, but yes.
Well, hey, I mean, he got what he wanted.
He really did. So, he got what he wanted ultimately.
Now, before we wrap up, I do want to ask, what is this autobiography? Is this something like a book that anyone can get, or did Elvis just have these little autobiographies he had written to pass out?
That is a great question, Vinny. And I wish I knew the answer to it. I looked a little bit before we recorded, and I really haven't been able to find any information about it. So if anybody who's listening knows about the short autobiography about himself that Elvis also included to President Nixon, I would really enjoy seeing it. I imagine it might also just be another scribbled memo, but that doesn't show up.
That's what I'm kind of wondering.
Like, yeah, but I wasn't able to. So there's actually a really great little Smithsonian tool describing detailing this meeting that has all the documents that are associated with and photos and all this great stuff. But it does not include the autobiography. So I don't know where it, because that would show up in the, you know, in the archive. So I don't know where that ended up or if I just happened to miss it. But it is it would be interesting. Just born in Memphis.
named one of the America's 10 most outstanding young men.
Yeah. Don't spell my middle name with two A's.
Oh, what is his middle name?
Oh, his middle name is Aaron. Elvis Aaron Presley. But it's A-R-O-N. Which is one of the things that leads to the, you know, Elvis is still alive conspiracy theories. Because on his official gravestone, it's spelled A-A-R-O-N.
Oh.
So, you know how people will latch on to things like that. So there are additional documents associated with this. I don't see I've got the memo, I've got the letter and, you know, an additional memo and a thank you note, but I don't see, I haven't been able to find his mentioned autobiography. So unfortunately.
That seems crazy that not only did Nixon have to take the time to just on the spur of the moment meet with Elvis, he then had to write a thank you note, and all of this had to be documented and everything had to be cataloged. So it makes me think it might have been hard to get anything done.
That's why the president's staff is so vast and extensive. I doubt that Nixon personally wrote the thank you note. I'm sure it was written on his behalf. So it's unfortunately not something the president often has a lot of time to do. I'm sure there are moments where he will take take the initiative to do something like that. But it's
Normally I would think good use of your time, but poor Elvis. If he knew, I feel he would just be crushed.
Oh yeah, he probably would. Yeah. Especially with how much he appreciated the president's time.
Yeah. But what a consolation to become a federal agent at large.
Absolutely. Exactly what he wanted. And hopefully it brought him some kind of peace or happiness. It just really, really seems like a very specific obsession of his. Maybe too much time studying communist brainwashing. Maybe it just addled his own brain.
So one last thing, let me ask, how often is it that two of America's 10 most outstanding young men and men meet?
That's a really great question. I'm not sure how often they, I mean, it's got to be like the you've got to have a designated survivor, right? I would imagine,
right.
Pretty outstanding.
So Elvis in the letter says, you know, just so you know I'm legit.
I was nominated this coming year, one of America's 10 most outstanding young men.
And then in the PS he says,
I believe that you, sir, were one of the top 10 outstanding men of America also.
This might be kind of nitpicking a little, but are those two different awards?
What Elvis is talking about here, as far as I know, is really just the same award. He says young men in one place and says men in another, but both Elvis and Nixon received the same award from this. This was, and actually still is, something given by what was then known as the United States Junior Chamber, also called the JCs. These days, it's JCI USA. I'm not sure if that's supposed to stand for something. Probably still something related to, you know, Junior Chamber. But although these days it's called Outstanding Young Americans, not Young Men.
That's nice.
Yes. So progress. So it's given each year to 10 Americans who ages 18 to 40 who, you know, this organization feels exemplify, you know, strong qualities of this nation's young people. Young people.
So I don't know how 40. Old Nixon was, but I assume that they weren't given the award on the same year.
They were not.
And Nixon was over 40, right? At this point.
Nixon was over 40 at this point. So Elvis received the award the year that he wrote this letter, 1970, and he was 35 at the time. Nixon received it in 1947 when he was 34. So they were about the same age when they received the award. And so, yes, they might have endeared him a little bit to, they both are these, you know, recognized individuals. And it was a pretty exclusive, pretty exclusive award, only given to 10 people a year. So
I turn 34 next Tuesday.
I'll
check for my nomination in the mail.
And then when you're 35, you could officially run for president.
Oh.
No interest in that?
No, it's more just like it highlights my lack of accomplishment up until this point.
Aww. Well, for what it's worth, very few people who are 35 have ever become president. So it's just a constitutional, you know, speed bump you pass over. Mm-hmm. So, but no. All right. Now I'm about to start going off talking about the youngest presidents and no, that'll be a
totally different episode.
Yeah. So that is the story of when Elvis Presley met Richard Nixon. And we are definitely going to make sure that we have links to the images, the pictures that were taken during this meeting, because it is, I don't know. I think it's so surreal with Nixon in the Oval Office, and then Elvis in his very, very Elvis outfit, his very Elvis jumpsuit.
He wore the jumpsuit?
Oh, yes.
Nice.
It is something special, these pictures. And it just gives me, as you know, maybe sad as his you know, motivations or mental state were at the time, it just gives me great joy as someone who's interested in Elvis's life and you know, unfortunately, eventually the downward path that it took. But it's just it just entertains me quite a lot to see this.
Well, that's great. It's a win-win then. You get the mental image of them meeting. Elvis gets his badge.
That's very true. Good point. Thank you for listening to Primary, Taking the People of the Past at Their Word. I'm Aaron Rock.
I'm Vinny Scutiero. And until next time, don't call it the establishment, call it America. And love it.
And love it.
You don't look interested in what I just said. If you're not listening, then don't nod your head.
This has been Primary, produced and edited by me, Chris Rock. visit our website at primaryshow.com. Follow us on Twitter at Primary Show. Aaron is at Arema, A-R-A-E-M-A, and Vinny is Blueberry Bark. Thank you to Jonathan Colton for use of the song Sticking to Myself off the album Artificial Heart as our intro and outro music. This has been a production of Rock Squid Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
So many juicy outtakes, Chris.
I know. You've got it covered now, Chris. All the me not knowing every single presidential campaign. I do appreciate the credit.
Neither of us have done an Elvis impression or a Nixon impression yet.